Just as an aside, I really appreciate the last line of this gospel reading, where you have this whole crowd gathered. There's this commotion of people wailing because this little girl has died. And Jesus insists that she's just sleeping, that they're all wrong. They laugh at him in their indignation. And I just try to picture yourself getting to a place of just losing a loved one who's a little girl and getting to the point of it being such an affront of what someone says that you laugh at them. And then Jesus tells them after he raises her from the dead that, you know, don't tell anyone about this, right? Like, I don't want anyone to know. I can only imagine how ineffective a command that had to have been. But no, this is such an interesting gospel lesson. And it's because half the time I'm looking at the gospel reading, I'm trying to figure out what it is in particular I want to point at or I want to look at or I want to preach about. And in this, there's almost like two completely distinct stories. At least that's how it feels, right? You have this story of this leader of the synagogue going and begging Jesus to come and heal his daughter who is terminally ill. Jesus leaving to do that. And then on the way, there's this whole other story of this woman who is hemorrhaging, right? And then the story concludes with the leader of the synagogue again. And in writing in the ancient Near East at this time, in the culture in which the Gospel of Mark was written, this is a very intentional thing. This isn't just in the way we think of it, oh, this is an interlude, this is something that's happening as part of a larger story. Because they didn't, like, the authors at this time weren't too concerned about chronology. It was not super important to authors to keep everything in exactly the right order, the way we would feel compelled to do if we were telling a story. They were much more comfortable moving things around in order to make a point, in order to communicate more clearly what they were trying to communicate. And so for this to be inserted right in the middle of another story is really unusual. And I offer that just so that we can be aware that it's something for us to note. Whenever you see something like that when you're reading the Bible, it's something worth paying attention to. And so I want to start there before coming back around to Jairus and his daughter. Jesus at this time, you notice the leader, they're not calling him Messiah, right? They're calling him teacher, rabbi. They're viewing him as someone who has the authority to teach, has the authority to kind of interpret and explain the scriptures to them. But he is not being viewed as God's son. He is not being viewed as the Messiah at this point by the people in this pericope, in this story, okay? What they do know about Jesus is that there's something different about him, and he seems to have the power to heal and to work miracles. Now understand, that wasn't just reserved for God, right? There were all kinds of magic workers and different people who claimed that they could heal you of different diseases. Notice what they say about the woman hemorrhaging, that she had spent everything she had on all the different doctors and things to help her be made well, and that she didn't get well, in fact she got worse. There were plenty of places to go that people that claimed to be able to heal, and where people had stories of being healed by those people. Otherwise, you don't give your money to them, right? And she's broke after doing everything she can with what is available to her at the time. So she gets close. She's just thinking, if I can just touch Jesus' robe, I will be healed, right? And we focus on her, but what you realize, when Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" And his disciples almost laugh at him, like, "What do you mean you touch it? Everyone is touching you. What are you talking about?" Because the crowd gathered in on him. Most of those people weren't just trying to get in Jesus' space. They were also trying to touch him. They were also trying to get his attention because there was something that most of them wanted, whether it was healing or whatever it was, that they knew he had the power to do, and they wanted it as well. So why is this one person the one whom the story is about? Why is this woman the person who comes to the fore? Because I'll tell you what, it's not traditionally, you know, who would be the focus of the story. In fact, it would have been anathema that this woman was even in the crowd in the first place. If you know a little bit about Jewish law at the time, anyone who was hemorrhaging, anyone where there was blood involved, made you unclean in Jewish tradition, and you had to. Your job was to stay away from other people and let other people around you know what was going on, so that they didn't come near you, touch you, and become unclean as well. Because ritual cleanliness was a very important piece of this culture. At least the folks who had the privilege of living up to those kinds of standards. And so for her to be gathered into a crowd, into a crush of people at this time, would have been really, really unacceptable culturally speaking. And she presses herself in because she just knows that this is the only chance she has. She reaches out and touches Jesus' clothing, and she's healed immediately, and she is aware of it immediately. And Jesus stops and turns. And the thing that she was hoping did not happen or would not happen, right, happens. And he says, "Who touched me?" She was hoping she could just kind of slink away, you know, and just, and like, you know, and that would be that. But she gets identified. She doesn't get identified. She gets called out, and what does she do? She comes and she falls at his feet. The exact same thing that the synagogue leader did at the beginning of the story, right? Falls at his feet and says, "It was me." And I don't know if she's expecting a reprimand. I don't know if she's just grateful. I don't know exactly what she's experiencing. But Jesus does not come with a reprimand. Jesus doesn't come. Remember, he's a teacher of the law. Who should know better than the inappropriateness of what she just did? And he turns, and what does he say? "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." We have inherited a lot of these traditions, not maybe in the same way, right? You know, we don't cast people out of town because they're unclean, because of like a wound on their skin or because they're bleeding or something like that. But we have lots and lots of rules of ethics, of morality that we kind of have as a society really decided we want to be ingrained in us and be a part of our culture, especially in the Christian church, at least in my experience. A lot of us probably aren't even aware of half of them, right? We just kind of react to different things and to the things people say and the things people do just naturally and don't even necessarily realize or know why we feel that way. There's a lot about how we are raised in this tradition that we just kind of hold on to and that just kind of becomes a part of us. For me growing up, it was, I remember I played Dungeons and Dragons when I was in middle school. And it ended up being, I only played for a really short period of time with one of my friends and a couple of his friends. And it was this really fantastic part of my life because I was in middle school and socially awkward, and having some people I could sit down with and like do something social that wasn't a video game, that was conversational. And I remember, I seem to recall folks telling me and my mom how bad an idea that was and how it was, you know, because Dungeons and Dragons at that time, at least, I don't know if it was this church or somewhere else, it was bad. Magic was bad. You probably heard some of this around the Harry Potter thing, you know, years ago. I just shouldn't be playing D&D. And later on, when I started playing Magic, the Gathering, which is a card game, that was completely unacceptable. So that was one of the things I inherited growing up. That I say is because it feels like one of the more kind of silly things now, looking back. There were other things that I internalized that were much more damaging to myself and to my, you know, growing up. But at the same time, and I don't want to just be negative, I mean, there's plenty of things that I inherited from this tradition about how to live and what it means to love and what it means to be filled with grace and with joy and with peace that are incredible. And I am eternally grateful and thankful that that was a part of my upbringing. That was a part of who I am. And so I don't want to focus on one side and not the other. The point I'm making is that we bring a lot of stuff with us into this room most of the time. And the thing that strikes me over and over again about Jesus is he seems in so many of his stories and so many of his statements just to cut across a lot of that. You know, maybe the Sabbath and healing on the Sabbath, maybe ritual purity and those kinds of things aren't our thing, right? Those aren't the things we get stressed out about in our culture or society, but they very much did in Jesus' day. And he cuts right through it and he says, you know, why wouldn't I heal someone on the Sabbath? The Sabbath is made for you and for us, not for God. Why wouldn't I look at you and want you to be well as he looks at this woman who has been suffering for so many years? See, the thing is, God and Christ want us to be well. Want us to embrace the parts of our tradition and our lives and our upbringing that bring life, that call us into love and into grace, into peace and into hope. And at the same time, God's love and grace desires for us to be able to be free of and to let go of the negative things we've internalized. That someone told us we're wrong just because, or someone told us we're wrong because that's not the way we do things around here. That's not the way we talk. That's not the way we do that. That's not the way we handle this particular situation. In my experience, if you live long enough in this church, you run into something that feels alienating. You have at least one conversation that makes you feel like you don't belong. I'm a priest in this church, and I've certainly felt it. Some of you maybe have felt it here, and I apologize if that's been the case from the depths of my heart. When you bring people together, it gets messy. And you hear me talk about this a lot. It gets complicated, and we have lots of different things that we grew up with. We didn't all grow up in this church and have the same exact way of thinking. We come from all different places. Some of us have been Christians all our lives. Some of us might not consider themselves Christians today. And that's all okay. Wherever you find yourself in that mix is okay. But what it means is that we have different ideas about what is right and wrong. We have different ideas about how to do this thing. We're one of the churches, one of the few places I've been at least, where we seem to have a balance of people who voted in both parties of the last election and still shake hands at the peace and still talk to one another at coffee hour. We live in a very contentious society, and somehow we strive to make this a place where we can kind of figure things out together, where we can try to set aside some of the baggage and the issues that we hold on to, that we kind of have internalized over our lives, and learn to live together. I held my thought that whole time. That was good. I'm getting better at this. Yeah. Now I'm going to lose it. I'm going to have an aside and completely forget where I was going. And so that's the piece of the hemorrhaging woman, right? That's that interlude in the center. Now I want to talk a little bit about Jairus. I want to talk a little bit about this other situation. Because remember, he's doing things correctly. And I want to draw that, you know, and I don't really mean that she did things incorrectly. I just mean for the culture at the time, right? She did things in ways that would have been considered culturally or morally inappropriate. You have the leader of the synagogue, right? This is the person who is looked to. This is the kind of the holiest of people in the town, right? This is the person that has been asked to organize and to be in charge of the worship of this community. So he knows how to do everything correctly, at least the way he was taught. And he comes and he throws himself at the feet of Jesus and he says, "Please, my daughter is sick. We don't know what to do. Will you please come and heal her?" Right? He falls and he shows deference. He asks in a way that shows, you know, that kind of respect, and he waits for Jesus to respond to him. And when Jesus says, "Yes, I'll come with you," you can imagine how he would feel, you know, because at that point he wouldn't have known what Jesus was going to do. He wasn't about to try to reach out and just hope that it was going to work. He was going to request Jesus' presence to come and do this thing. And on the way, things get chaotic, right? People gather around him, and he stops to have this conversation with this woman. And I don't know how long all of this took. I don't know if this really extended the walk to this man's house or not. But whatever happens, it's long enough for people to come from his house and say, "It's too late. Don't bother the teacher any further. She's already died." Can you imagine how frustrated you must feel? Going through all the proper ways of asking the teacher to come and take care of your daughter, for him to stop and take care of other people along the way who aren't doing it the right way, who are just kind of forcing their way in to try to touch Jesus in a way that is completely unacceptable in the culture, and then to find out that that was part of delaying him long enough that your daughter has died in the meantime. And let me just step back from the story. Like, just take the pieces of what I just said. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you feel like you've done everything the way you're supposed to be doing it? And then you feel like someone else kind of cut corners, or someone else did it another way and they got ahead or they won in the end? Anyone feel that way? I'll be honest. I have a feeling a lot of our nation's frustration, politically speaking and socially speaking, comes down to that question. Look at the question of immigration, right? The question isn't we don't care. No one says they don't care about these people. Well, few people say they don't care about these people who are trying to find a better life. They say we have a law and you need to follow it. Or they say we need to be graceful and we need to let people in, right? That's the debate I hear, at least publicly, from most people. It's we've got to do it the right way, and it's not fair for other people to be let in another way. Like the dreamers question, all of these other things, everything at least I've heard in the news around immigration. Just take that one particular thing, which I know is a real easy topic to pick up right now. It's real lighthearted for a Sunday sermon. But it's so similar. And I'm not telling you the right way to do this, right? Jesus responds to both of these people. Jesus heals the woman who does it the wrong way. And he, even though the The leader of the synagogue says, don't bother coming. It's too late. Jesus knows it's not really too late. And he goes and he says, she's just sleeping. And he raises her from the dead, right? Jesus is with both of these people. Jesus heals both of these people as they request. I'm not standing here to tell you the right way to think, but I do beg you to start practicing learning to live in the nuance of where we live, both in our faith and in our country. The things that we face as a people, the things we face as a church are hard questions, and they don't have easy answers. And I can't just tell you what to do, even though a lot of people in my position really like to do that, especially about some of these political and social issues. I might disagree with you and how you view things in this country and in this world. That's okay. I need you to wrestle with it, though. I need you to live in the tension and to join me in trying, even though it's so hard sometimes, to listen and to hear what the other side is saying. Because if there's one thing I get from this passage, it's that God in Christ works to bring us together, to heal us and to make us well, to unify us and to let us carry on together and not apart. I am in a place where I'm very worried about the things that I feel and experience, the things that I hear being said and things being experienced in our culture, in our country, in our world today. The thing that's hardest for me is watching the people I agree with write off people that I disagree with. And I'm hoping and banking on this place, meaning the church, being one of the few places that I have found where we can actually continue to listen to one another and to not judge one another because we disagree with someone, but instead learn how to love one another in the midst of our disagreement over things. I've tried to live in a church. I've tried to live in a faith community where the way in which we live together is by just agreeing that we're all going to live exactly the same way. It's exhausting. It doesn't work. And there's maybe one person that it's made for. And that often happens to be the person standing in this pulpit. What I hope we can learn to do and continue to do, I think we are doing this, but what I hope we can continue to do is just continue to learn how to kind of empty ourselves, how to let ourselves be free, how to let ourselves be open to one another, to listening to one another, and to allowing the love and the grace of God to be within us, to call us into new life, to call us into healing, to call us into joy. And I pray that that in time will knit us closer together rather than driving us further apart. And again, I don't know what that looks like. I don't know how it's going to work. I know it's not always going to be exactly what I want to do, and probably not what you want to do all the time either. And we're going to mess it up, and we're going to be better and worse at it at other times. But I really do hope that in the midst of this place where we live with a lot of diversity, we would become a people who are better and better at listening. We would become a people who are better and better at hearing one another. And in the midst of our differences, learning how to build a brighter and more beautiful people of God, a brighter and more beautiful community of people who gather in order to worship and to live our lives seeking and pursuing love and joy and peace. Amen.